You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the story is getting much, much more complicated hour by hour as we continue to talk. The French came out and said, okay, cool. If President Putin and President Obama are going to come up with a deal, and President Assad, I guess is his title, al-Assad of Syria is willing to make a deal, then we're going to put forward a proposal in the Security Council and for the entire United Nations on the assumption that this time Russia and China won't veto it. But the proposal that the French put together had a little thing in it that basically said that, you know, if the Americans didn't like it, they could still bomb Syria. So the Russian foreign minister said, you got to take that thing out. And so now there's basically, I mean, this is what's called negotiating, right? But the backstory to this is fascinating. When I signed off the air yesterday afternoon, I suggested, we had just talked with former Congressman Bob Ney, who's now a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, who reported that John Kerry's comment about, well, gee, you know, if the reporter asked John Kerry, what could Syria do that would cause you not to bomb them? And he said if within a week they got rid of all their nuclear weapon or all of their chemical weapons and put them under the control of, you know, international bodies, then we would stop. We would withdraw our commitment to bomb them. My phrase, not his. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, here. And so immediately, two things happened. One, the foreign minister for Russia comes forward and says, hey, good idea. Let's ask Assad if he will, you know, as the president of Syria, if he'll go along with this. And the, you know, within minutes of that, the foreign minister of Syria tweets out, yes, we'll do this. And then the White House says to some of the reporters, and this is what Bob Ney had reported on our show yesterday, just a few minutes after it happened, that Secretary of State Kerry's comments were basically shooting from the hip, that he didn't have the authority to say that, that he was speaking in metaphor, not making an actual offer. And so as we were going off the air yesterday afternoon in the 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern time hour, I was saying, so call the White House comment line and let them know what you think. And when I got off the air, and somebody in the chat room said they're closed for the day. I was like, what? It's got to be a joke, right? So we get off the air at 6 o'clock, and I dial 202-456-1111, the White House comment line. And sure enough, there's a recording going, sorry, we're closed for the day. Call back between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. Eastern time, as I recall. In fact, did you record that, Shannon? No, you missed it. Okay, no problem. Anyhow, it was hysterical. It was like, oh, I can't believe this. But in any case, the message got out, and so what was happening was, like, you know, the left was organizing around this, saying, okay, you know, let's push Obama to do this deal that Kerry seems to have inadvertently and perhaps even stupidly offered. Not stupidly, but, you know, unthinkingly. And then, you know, I go home and I start digging into this thing. And I saw this interview with Gwen Ifill on PBS that Obama did, where she says, basically, she's asking the question, you know, is this something that just popped virgin fresh to the world out of John Kerry's mouth earlier today, or did you and President Putin talk about this back last week when you guys were hanging out at the G20 in that private meeting you guys had? And, well, here's the conversation.
Now we're hearing news that Russia has a plan, a solution, perhaps, which would allow Syria to take all of its weapons and right. Put it under international control. Is that something that you've had any conversations at all with President Putin about when you were in St. Petersburg last week?
I did have those conversations. And this is a continuation of conversations I've had with President Putin for quite some time.
So here's a conversation I've had with President Putin for quite some time. Yes, we talked about it back a week ago, the G20. In other words, Republicans, you've been punked. I mean, this obviously would not be the first time that a Secretary of State has had a reporter ask a question that the Secretary of State knew was coming and had an answer ready for, or perhaps even encouraged a reporter to ask and had an answer ready for. The right wing last night, Hannity and Coulter and whatnot, they went off on this thing. And I didn't see this. Shana was telling me about it a few minutes ago. But I just hit a certain threshold where I can't handle it anymore. Shane has much more intestinal fortitude than I when it comes to Fox. And anyhow, he said basically that Hannity's meme was and Coulter's was, oh, look at this. This is making Putin look strong and making Obama look weak. Right. It's making the Republicans look like, to me, like they've been had. They've been punked. We'll see how this plays out, and we'll see how much there is there, and we'll see what the president has to say tonight. But if John Kerry just blurted something out, then why is the president saying, yeah, President Putin and I have been talking about this for a while? I mean, in fact, this is a New York Times article that pretty interesting. New York Times article says, quote, Mr. Lavrov, now that's the Russian foreign minister, the guy who initially responded to Kerry. He's the equivalent of Kerry's Secretary of State. He's kind of the Russian Secretary of State. Mr. Lavrov said he had discussed the proposal with the Americans before announcing it at a hastily arranged briefing on Monday evening. Mr. Obama and Mr. Putin discussed the idea privately on the sidelines of last week's summit of the Group of 20 Nations, and Mr. Lavrov discussed it with Secretary of State John Kerry. Really? Now, all over Washington, D.C., I guarantee you, or all around America, as all the Republicans might not be back in town here yet, all the legislators, but they're going, oh, really? So, what, you know, basically, it looks to me, and I could be wrong, and time will tell, but this is starting to look more like three-dimensional chess. And the closer we get to the implementation of Obamacare, I'm increasingly thinking that that's three-dimensional chess, particularly with the 2016 escape clause that allows Vermont and Montana to go single-payer. That's built into Obamacare. It's increasingly looking to me like either Obama said to Putin or Putin, either Obama said to Putin, hey, I got a problem. You know, I made this statement, and I got to play a Kennedy clip for you after the break where Kennedy made basically the same mistake that led to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Obama says, you know, I got this problem, and I don't want to have the Cuban Missile Crisis. And can you help me out? And or Putin came to him and said, you know, I think I can bail you out here. Whichever way it happened, I don't care, and I just think it's brilliant that these two guys got together a week ago and game-played this thing to avoid a war, or avoid the superpowers, either one of the two superpowers, involving themselves directly in this civil war that's going on in Syria, which, as we've been discussing, is something that's going to be affecting, shall we say, the interests of both nations significantly. And war would be the worst thing for it. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So the question of the day, I suppose, did Putin and Obama outsmart the Republican Party? Or is that just too cute by half? Welcome back. So this is absolutely fascinating. Your opinions are welcome, but my opinion is increasingly that Obama he started out. Here's my chronology. In fact, let's go back into the Wayback Machine. Back in 1962, John Kennedy was asked in a press conference, "What will you do if offensive weapons are put into Cuba, or if Cuba, you know, puts arms itself. And Kennedy, off the cuff, said, basically, we'll meet it with a vigorous response, or words to that effect, very strong response. Now, back in the 60s, there was, in 62, there was this huge battle going on between Jack Kennedy and Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon had been defeated in the election of 1960 by a whisker, and he was going to run again. And the way that Kennedy defeated Nixon in the 1960 election was by criticizing Nixon for being weak on communism. Because Nixon had been vice president, he'd been in charge of the whole Cuba thing in the Eisenhower administration, and Nixon had participated in and kind of overseen the Cuban Revolution, where initially we actually thought, Nixon actually thought, America thought, that Castro, in overthrowing the dictator Batista, was going to become a small-D Democrat. He was going to turn into a democratic nation and be an ally of ours, sort of like George W. Bush thought that when he overthrew Saddam Hussein, that Iraq would align itself with us. The fact of the matter is they've aligned themselves with Iran now, but pretty much officially. But so things don't always work out, right? So Kennedy beat Nixon by beating him up for not being sufficiently tough on communists in the 1960 election, by saying that Nixon and then you know, Castro then aligned himself with the Soviet Union in 59-60, and Kennedy used that Nixon let Castro go communist to win the 1960 election. So in 61 and 62 and through 63 and 64, obviously, Kennedy was assassinated in November of 63, but, you know, throughout that four-year period, it fell to Lyndon Johnson to defend the anti-communist position against Nixon's assaults, and he did that by going to Vietnam. But during that time, Kennedy had to be, you know, a real tough guy because Nixon was campaigning, you know, to run again for president, which he ultimately did in 72, or in 68, excuse me. And so Kennedy knew that he had to sound like a tough guy when he was asked about, you know, if Cuba gets offensive weapons, what will you do? Because, I mean, that's how he had beat Nixon in the 1960 election. He had to continue that, you know, beating that drum. And so he made this offhand remark. The offhand remark then caused the Republicans and Nixon and the whole, you know, to just for a week or so go hysterical and say, well, you know, we've never heard this before from this administration. We thought he was just a wimp, you know, how could he say it? You know, blah, 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 blah. And so Kennedy comes out the following week, and this is the week of, September 12th, 1962, or September 13th. He comes out and opens his press conference with a very brief prepared statement responding to all the furor in the press from Nixon and the Republicans over the previous week, basically saying about him the same thing Hannity is saying about Obama right now. And so Kennedy says this.
If at any time the communist buildup in Cuba were to endanger or interfere with our security in any way, including our base at Guantanamo, our passage to the Panama Canal, our missile and space activities at Cape Canaveral, or the lives of American citizens in this country, or if Cuba should ever attempt to export its aggressive purposes by force or the threat of force against any nation in this hemisphere, or become an offensive military base of significant capacity for the Soviet Union, then this country will do whatever must be done to protect its own security and that of its allies. We shall be alert to and fully capable of dealing swiftly with any such development. As President and Commander-in-Chief, I have full authority now to take such action.
I have full authority now to take such action. So basically the same kind of question was put to Obama a year ago. This was a year and a month ago, back in August of 2012. The Republicans were all, you know, oh, look at the Arab Spring, but look at what's going on in Syria, and Assad is how they say it in Syria, is, you know, killing his own people. And, we got to figure out a way to kind of pin Obama down on this. And somebody says, well, what would you do if he used chemical weapons. And Obama says, well, that would be a red line. You know, if he did that, he'd cross that red line and the United States would get involved. This is a year ago. So Obama, by saying that, was basically handing a gift. And I don't think that he said it with a lot of I don't think he gamed this one out in advance, although I could be wrong. But basically what he did is he handed the Republicans and but more importantly, the rebels in Syria a weapon, basically. He said to the rebels in Syria, if you want the United States to join your side to attack Assad, all you have to do is make it look like poison gas was used by Assad against his own people. And so, in my opinion, now, and I may well be wrong on this. I mean, it may well be that Assad gassed his own people, but I cannot figure out why. There is no political purpose. The area that it was done in was partly under Assad's control, partly under the rebels' control. It didn't accomplish any political victory. In fact, it hurt Assad. It didn't accomplish any military victory. So I'm of the opinion that the rebels did this to pin it on Assad so that Obama would find himself backed into a corner, which he did. And so he and Putin get together a week ago and say, you know, well, how can we get ourselves out of this? Because eventually we're going to come in conflict over this because Russia has this military base in Syria. And it looks like they've worked it out. I think this is pretty cool.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, I may be completely wrong, and all of this is subject to what President Obama says tonight and what happens over the course of the next week. So we have to, you know, we'll see. Welcome back, 28 minutes before the hour, and Miley Cyrus has a new video. Well, naked, see, this is what happens when you go to Huffington Post looking for the story. Apparently, yeah, I'm over at Democratic Underground, and there's this headline that says, breaking, Syria will declare its chemical weapons arsenal, sign chemical weapons convention. Click through to Huffington Post, and here I am looking at Miley Cyrus. Why do we care? Well, in any case, Syria, this the Associated Press, actually Huffington Post reprinted the AP story, so let's just attribute it to the AP. Syria's foreign minister says that President Bashar al-Assad, they didn't put the al, Bashar Assad's regime will declare its chemical weapons arsenal. Now, declaring that you've got them is a big deal. He's been up to this point denying that he had them. And will sign the Chemical Weapons Convention. That's an even bigger deal because that means that they're committing to put them under international control, to put them under UN supervision and observation, and to eventually destroy them. And not to manufacture them anymore, assuming that they have been. I mean, they may well have been buying them from others. The stuff that Saddam Hussein was using when he was gassing the Iranians during the Reagan administration, when Ronald Reagan was providing Saddam Hussein with intelligence as to where the Iranian forces were so that he could kill them with poison gas. That poison gas was coming from France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. So who knows where Syria got theirs from, but although there are reports that came from Britain. Back to the Associated Press. Waleed al-Mualim, this is the Syrian equivalent of John Kerry, the Syrian foreign minister, secretary of state, whatever his title is. Also says Syria is ready to cooperate fully to implement a Russian proposal to put its chemical weapons arsenal under international control, and it will stop producing chemical weapons. He adds that Syria will also place chemical weapons locations in the hands of representatives of Russia, other countries, and the United States. And the United States. Let me say that one more time. He also adds that Syria will place chemical weapons locations in the hands of the United States. Wow. Looks to me like mission accomplished. Only this time, you know, Obama doesn't need to get in a flight suit and stuff a sock down there and fly onto an aircraft carrier. He just walk out in front of the world tonight and stand there like the, you know, rather elegant young gentleman that he is and say, okay, we got this one. Chill out. George Bush was at least humorous, you know. Looking back on it, I mean, it's tragically humorous. Millions of people, literally hundreds of thousands of people died. Millions of people's lives were destroyed by his antics. And he's nowhere to be seen now. I mean, Jimmy Carter came right out and said, striking Libya is not a good idea. You know, it's not, in fact, it's not even a legal idea. Again, I'm paraphrasing. So, anyhow, but you know, I promised your thoughts. Let's let you in on this. Don in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Don.
Hello there. Let me get back on the phone here.
Good idea.
Hello?
Yeah.
All along for this, but the question, it still begs the question, why did he do it in the first place, sir?
Why did who do what?
Our president.
Why did he say that chemical weapons are a red line?
Not that. That he's actually going to act on it and attack.
Oh, well, he did that because...
Seth, I have an opinion on that, if you'll forgive me, sir.
Certainly. I didn't realize you were speaking. I thought you were asking a question.
I'm sorry. He had no intention of ever attacking. He had an intention of creating a great debate, which did several things. Took away the Snowden affair. Took all the steam out of the room for that one.
Yep.
But number two, in this, you know, everybody's, but why is he doing it? Why is he doing it? Why is he doing it? guess what? G20 never discussed what they're all there to do there in the first place. Rein in the international ripoff of billions of dollars by the corporations.
Well, they actually did pass a resolution that they were going to call on countries to... it wasn't even a resolution. It was essentially a legislative action that these countries were going to get together and come up with an international income tax so that corporations can't hide their income taxes can't hide their income offshore anymore. I mean, that was a big deal.
It was never discussed by the public. It was never brought out. There was no focus on it. There was
an article about it in the New York Times. I mean, it was discussed in the press conferences. Obama talked about it when he was interviewed, when he was over there. It wasn't a secret.
Oh, of course it wasn't a secret. There's only something you can do. You got to take the oxygen out with something else.
Yeah.
I
don't disagree, Don, that they didn't go in and say, okay, we're going to bust up the big banks. We've got to do this for the survival of the world economy and all that kind of thing. I mean, you know, the stuff that you and I would love to have seen them done, they didn't do, but they did take a small step in the right direction. But G20s are typically more opportunities for symbolism anyway. If these countries want to get together and really negotiate something, they don't do it with the leaders. They do it with the negotiators. They do it with the you know, the policy wonks and the experts, and they get all that stuff long before the meeting is held in place. The meetings are just photo ops.
Revolving doors apply to presidents also, as far as I'm concerned, sir. He's a young man. He's got a future. And he's going to make a lot of money, and him and his family is going to be running Washington, D.C. for a long time, just like the Clintons.
Yeah, it may well be. It may well be. I hope he goes the Jimmy Carter road, but you may well be right. Francine in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Francine.
Hi. I love your program.
Thank you.
And I definitely think you are onto something with Obama having a plan. I just kind of want to remind you of the open mic incident before the election with the Russians. Remember when he said he would be more flexible?
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, and he got trashed for it by Fox News.
Yeah, I'm sure this natural gas pipeline has been in the works for many, many years.
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows?
The pipeline, if you're talking about the pipeline across Syria, the natural gas one is the one that Qatar wants, and the oil one is the one that Saudi Arabia wants, and Russia doesn't want either one of them, because they'll, at least that's my understanding, because they'll compete with Russian supplies to... although one of those two, I think Saudi Arabia offered to do theirs collaboratively with the Russians, but not give them complete control over it. That was the deal that Bandar Bush tried to make. But very, very interesting. Thank you for the reminder on that, Francine. Joe in Worth, Illinois. Hey, Joe.
Hey, I just wanted to give you a call. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about this deal. I really think the deal is custom made for the Russians, and I don't like the way we look at this deal. We look as the United States. I'm going to tell you why. I think that Assad is getting away with literally murder on this deal. The Russians got him to just give up his chemical weapons in return for us not to bomb him. And Assad gets his weapons from Russia. We are supposedly arming the rebels. And Assad gets to stay in his regime. And he gets no punishment at all except for giving up his weapons. Now, I think that the
punishment
United States
for what?
Insist that he gets brought up on war crimes.
Well, that option's not off the table, Joe.
I think it should be ultimately the only deal, because he's getting away literally with murder if we agree to only to not to bomb him, only to agree to for him to give up his, weapons of mass destruction or whatever you want to call them. I mean,
assuming that he was responsible for gassing his own citizens, then yes, I completely agree with you. If he was not responsible for it, then the people who are getting away with this arguably are the so-called rebels who cut the hearts of their enemies out and eat them on YouTube videos and assassinate people on videos that were on the front page of the New York Times just a few days ago, and people who proudly proclaim their allegiance to al-Qaeda, the largely Sunni Muslims who are being funded to the tune of $3 billion, if the reports are correct, by Qatar, and millions and perhaps hundreds of millions or billions of dollars by Saudi Arabia. And by us. And I think that, and keep in mind, Assad is an Alawite, which is essentially a Shia. But Assad has been running a regime that is secular. He has not been running, Syria is not a Muslim state. It is not, it's not officially a Muslim state like Iran and Iraq are now. And that's one of the things that really has the al-Qaeda folks' panties in a wad that they're all upset about. So, I think from this long distance, there's a certain, we need to let them sort this stuff out, in my mind. Joe, thanks for the call. Lance in Clinton, Kentucky. Got just a minute left, Lance. It's yours.
Yeah, I have an opinion on, everybody's got their opinion on why Obama did this and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what people are missing is, what was the Republicans' main goal for this summer's recess?
To end Obamacare.
Right. And what did he do? By bringing up Syria.
He took the air out of the room for that one, didn't he?
That's what I think he's just doing.
Yeah. Well, that may well be. That may well be. He also, the Republicans' big threat with regard to ending Obamacare was that, around the middle of October, the government's going to run out of money and they were going to, crash our government if they couldn't defund Obamacare. And now John Boehner's walking that one back, too. So... Lance, you may be right. This is, like I said, this could be three-dimensional chess. He's winning on all kinds of levels. And the Republicans just continually are looking like idiots. And then you get the apologists on Fox who are like, oh, this shows that Putin's stronger than Obama. Really? I don't recall Putin initiating this whole threat of force thing. I mean, if that's your measure of strong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's frankly not my measure of strong, but I know it is the Republicans' measure of strong, and I know it is the Foxosphere's measure. By the way, just a quick heads up. In the next segment, Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin is going to be on with us. And I've got this article that Mark Ames published over at NSFW Corp., titled The True History of Libertarianism in America, a phony ideology to promote a corporate agenda, that I have to share with you at some point. I'll get into it as we go through the day here. It's just incredible and so revealing. Laura in Chicago. Hey, Laura, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I'm very happy about the turn of events here, but I do want to warn people about a couple things. I heard on one news report that Obama's going to continue to go to Congress for kind of an open-ended war resolution for Syria, against Syria, just in case this deal falls through. So we're going to have to be watching for that.
Well, he's going to almost have to do that, because if he doesn't, then all the Republicans are going to do what Nixon did to Kennedy back in the day and say, oh, look at he's wimping out. So, he's going to.
I think we should be against that as well.
I agree. And we are. I'm on, I'm on the advisory board of Progressive Democrats of America, pedamerica.org. And we've got this ad in the Hill. I think it's not the Hill. It's Roll Call today. that Tom Hayden wrote, saying, you know, it's time for forceful diplomacy, not forceful force. And
right, because, you know, Germany, for sure, has come up with evidence that Assad did not fire off these chemical weapons.
Yes.
There were chemical weapon attacks by the rebels that the UN has already declared previous to this.
Yes.
So I don't hear any talk about disarming the rebels
yeah.
from their chemical weapons and keeping Saudi Arabia and Qatar from, you know, sending them, the rebels, the chemical weapons. So I'm really worried that, you know, they diffused this present situation, but that the warmongers really do want to go into Syria.
Oh, of course. The neocons, there's never been a war they didn't like. There was never been a war they couldn't make money off of, basically. So there's never been a war they didn't like. So, Laura, you're right. We'll just have to see how this plays out. Thank you for the call. Judy in Northampton, Mass. Hey, Judy.
Hi. Gosh, I get nervous on the phone with you. I love your show. I love you and all the stuff you teach me.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that when this first happened and he started talking about, well, now he's going to have to take action because of the chemical weapons, I thought, well, he's probably just posturing because he doesn't want to look weak because he's already made the red line comment. And I kept thinking that, and then the more he talked about, you know, explaining to the American people, and he didn't back down. Like, I began to get madder and madder at him. But then this thing came up about him talking to Putin, and I thought, yeah, he had to look strong. He had to say, well, now we're going to have to do something. And he's really been fighting for, you know, going to Congress and getting it, and the Republicans are all up in arms and saying he's the worst president ever because of this.
Yeah, but with all this tough talk, you know, all the guys who drink beer and have hunting rifles in the back of their pickup trucks out in rural America, they're all going, hey, that guy's got some guts.
Anything Obama says makes him the worst president.
Well, no, I mean, I think they're actually starting to look at him and say, you know, this guy's got some backbone.
Well, that's what I think he's done it for.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
And then I thought when this Putin thing came out that he had talked with him about it, I thought he did this so because he had to look strong and he had to look hawkish, and because of his reputation, and he was planning to get out of it somehow. I think he had faith that the American people were not going to allow that. Because he knows we don't want to go to war.
Yeah.
And I think he just.
Yeah, he's said several times, you know, we're pretty good at polling here.
What?
He's said several times in his interviews, we're pretty good at polling here. We know, you know, so before he started, I think he knew at least to a large extent what the outcome was going to be. Judy, I want to get some more callers in here. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to WHMP. Albert, listening to WCPT in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. Hey, Albert, World War One.
Yeah, it's about our involvement in any kind of war. But I was just wondering, why did the U.S. get involved in World War One? Like,
because
what was the reason?
Because we had a treaty with, you know, I'm going to have to get a World War One scholar on, and we need to do a half hour segment on this thing and really go through it, because it's been, you know, I mean, I learned this stuff in high school, right? And that's what I'm drawing on for my information, which is a lousy source. But my recollection is that we had a treaty with England. England had a treaty with somebody else in Europe. Somebody else in Europe got attacked. But the whole thing started out because Archduke Ferdinand got assassinated in Sarajevo by a Serb. And Ferdinand represented the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. And so this was perceived as an act of war by the Serbs against them. And the Serbs were in cahoots with the Russians, and the Austro-Hungarians were in cahoots with the Germans. And you know, everybody had a mutual aid treaty with somebody else, and so when one country got hit, and you know, it was as if they all got hit and that kind of thing. So I don't know if I'm answering your question accurately, but the sense of it is certainly accurate.
Yeah, is that where NATO started? Like,
No, NATO came about after World War II.
The
North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Again, I'm not a scholar in the history of NATO, but I know it was much later than that. Albert, thanks for the call. We got 1 minute to the break here. David in Park Hills, Missouri. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Big fan of yours and Bernie Sanders. Hey, you said a few minutes ago Putin is no dummy. Actually, I was quite impressed when I heard him on an interview the other day. But yesterday, I was really deflated when I saw Charlie Rose talking to the president of Syria, because he really made himself look like a patsy of our government. I had a lot more admiration.
Charlie Rose did?
Yeah, I he had to have. I'm wondering if he actually drew a check from our government for that interview.
Yeah, this is how it works. Now that Charlie Rose is like, you know, a network television, this is how it works. If you're with the big networks, you've got to basically suck up to those in power, because if those in power don't come on your programs, particularly your Sunday programs, then you don't get any advertising revenue and you go out of business. So I didn't see the interview. I can't speak to what Charlie Rose did or didn't do. But whenever you see somebody in the media basically sucking up to the Democratic or Republican Party or the established power structure, that's typically what it's all about. David, thank you for the call. We'll be back with Congressman Mark Pocan from Wisconsin.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, the Libertarian Party was started in 1948 as a PR arm of the, originally the National Board of Realtors and a bunch of large corporations to fight rent control and promote pro-business concepts. Very strange. We will get into that in more detail later in the program. Right now, Congressman Mark Pocan is on the line with us, a U.S. Congressman from the 2nd District of the great state of Wisconsin. His website, Pocan, P-O-C-A-N, .house.gov. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
You are, one of the more outspoken, I'm not sure is the outspoken, well-spoken, well-known progressives in the House of Representatives. And I'm curious, what's your take on where things are at right now with regard to the United States, Russia, Syria, the UN, all this stuff that's unfolding before us. And if you don't mind, I'm curious what your take was 3 or 4 days ago before these new developments happened.
Sure. Well, you know, I've been to, I think, 3 of our classified briefings or calls with the White House as we looked at this issue. And, you know, I was troubled, as were, I think, some of the other progressives, that, you know, there really wasn't a compelling national security interest to many of us for us to get involved. I think we still had a lot of questions about what the end game was, what could happen if we did a military strike. A lot of us wanted to know what options were out there besides a military strike, where we were when building international support for some kind of response, maybe other than a military strike. So, you know, I have been saying publicly I did not support what the president was proposing. However, I think, as we all know, in the last 24 hours, it seems like every hour things change a little bit with the new proposal that's out there, that at least there seems to be interest, verbally anyway, from Syria on the Russian proposal to get rid of chemical weapons. It sounds like they're willing to sign the treaty. It sounds like a lot is moving, and I think that this is a good thing. And from what I'm understanding, everyone's kind of on hold now to vote for a military strike, and I think that's a good thing. Let's see where this can go. This is exactly, I think, the sort of response we were hoping for that would happen, getting an international community response that didn't involve a military strike, and now we're just anxious and hopeful that this will turn into something good.
President Putin had, President of Russia had a conversation with some reporters just, I guess, earlier today. This is reported in the New York Times just an hour or so ago. And I'm looking through this for the context of where and when he spoke. It doesn't say. But anyway, here's what he says. Undoubtedly, all this makes sense and can function. It can work only if we hear that the American side and those who support the United States in this sense rule out the use of force, because it is difficult to make any country, Syria or any country, any other government in the world, unilaterally disarm if the use of force is being prepared against it. And so he's taking, you know, Russia's taking that position. He added, and I thought this was a revelation, I mean, a pretty remarkable thing for the president of Russia to be saying. He noted that Syria had a certain arsenal of chemical weapons and that the Syrians have always, this is quoting Putin, the Syrians have always regarded it as an alternative to the nuclear weapons in Israel, end of quote. But they're willing to give that up. And that's, I think, pretty remarkable. Now, on the other hand, you've got Chuck Hagel and John Kerry, who today both said, Mr. Kerry said the use of force absolutely should not be off the table. And Hagel said, for this diplomatic option to have a chance of succeeding, the threat of U.S. military action must continue to be very real and credible. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. So we've got the Russians and the Americans saying two completely different things about how they're going to meet in the middle. What are your thoughts on all that?
You know, I think this is kind of a chicken and egg sort of debate. I mean, I think the White House and John Kerry and others have saying the reason they're at the table is because we threaten force. And you've got Russia saying, if you threaten force, I can't have this reasonable approach happen. So, you know, they're going to have that conversation. What I really hope is that, as I understand, we're not moving forward with a vote right now because this is on the table. And this is exactly, I think, what many of us had hoped. There'd be an international community response that wasn't a military strike that dealt with chemical weapons. And since we were told that this is to deal with chemical weapons, this seems like a strong solution if everyone plays in good faith, as the conversation I think right now is that we've been, you know, having unfold throughout the last 24 hours. It's a really good solution that we don't have to get involved in a civil war with a military strike that's a unilateral or largely unilateral strike with us being the world's policemen, and we don't have to worry about what some of the other ramifications could be from doing that and what could happen to those chemical weapons otherwise. So I think, you know, we're all on hold. That's what I hear is happening here. Granted, everything evolves almost hourly today, Tom, but I think there's some real positiveness in this, and I'm looking forward to hear the president talk tonight.
Back in the back in 62, Jack Kennedy was asked what he would do if Cuba was arming up. And, of course, the way that he won the 1960 election was by accusing Nixon of being soft on communism and letting Cuba go communist, which happened when Nixon was vice president. And for the first 2 years of the Kennedy administration, Nixon was out running around along with the John Birch Society and the rest of the Republican Party claiming that Kennedy was soft on Cuba, on communism. And so Kennedy made this offhand remark in a press conference that if Cuba armed up, he would basically kick their butts. And then a week or two later, he made a formal statement. Here's just the first 15 seconds of it, just so you get a sense of it.
If at any time the communist buildup in Cuba were to endanger or interfere with our security in any way, including our base at Guantanamo, our passage to the Panama Canal, our missile and space activities at Cape Canaveral, or the lives of American citizens in this country, or if Cuba should ever attempt to export its aggressive purposes by force or the threat of force against any nation in this hemisphere, or become an offensive military base of significant capacity for the Soviet Union, then this country will do whatever must be done to protect its own security and that of its allies.
And that was largely, and he went on to say, and as president, I have the authority to order it. He had kind of made his own red line comment, and then he had to amplify it. The president made his red line comment about Syria and the chemical weapons. Kennedy's led to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And isn't this now preventing a Cuban Missile Crisis equivalent if we can work this thing out?
If we can work this out, I think this is a...
And do you see those same parallels?
Yeah, I think we've been talking about this on the floor, some of us, just today, actually, with this very issue. I just see some great opportunity. If this is a sincere proposal, and if we go into it with the sincerity that I think, you know, if everyone goes into it with that kind of a sincerity, we've got a pretty good solution, I think, to look at, and I think that's what we're all watching. I was at a meeting this morning that, believe it or not, Rand Paul put together to try to talk about how, in a bipartisan way, we can make sure that we're not going to war.
Yeah.
And I think that's where many of us had a concern that that could be a logical place this could perhaps go into. This solution, I think, could solve everyone's problems, and I hope that everyone is really serious about their efforts in it.
Are you concerned? I've been saying for some time I am concerned. I'll just tell you up front that a U.S. strike on Syria could be an Archduke Ferdinand moment.
There's a lot of questions. Every single briefing I've been to or phone call I've been to with the White House, I've left with more questions, and a lot of them were around what's the end game, what could happen, and I think a lot of us are afraid that, you know, what could it escalate to if this happens and you take away, you know, we do a strike. What if someone else gets control of the chemical weapons? I mean, there's just so many questions that we had, and you know, again, this is the solution, right? Everyone said we're here to get rid of the chemical weapons.
Right.
If we can get someone else to sign, another country to sign it, and to get rid of the chemical weapons, that's a big victory for the international community.
It really is, because, I mean, if we took out Assad and al-Qaeda takes control of the chemical weapons and they throw them at Israel, then Israel nukes Syria, and then Iran nukes Israel, and then you know, we're in World War One all over again.
We definitely have boots on the ground, and that's what we don't want.
Yeah. Congressman Mark Pocan from the 2nd District of Washington, pocan.house.gov. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you.
Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, Archduke Ferdinand moment? Maybe not. Oh, and I got to tell you about how the Libertarian Party started. We will get to that, too. You ever heard of Malula? If you haven't, you are about to. This is a town in Syria. It is an ancient Christian town, Malula. And it was just attacked by rebels, in quotes, in other words, people who hate Assad. But in this case, it was the extremist Islamist rebels who attacked this Christian town with the intent of killing the Christians. Although the New York Times reports some of the rebels, apparently aware of their public relations problem, said in interviews that they meant Christians no harm. They filmed themselves talking politely with nuns, instructing fighters not to harm civilians or churches, and touring a monastery that appeared mostly intact. But the damage, the New York Times says, was already done. Most of the town's residents have fled, and Malula, one of the last places where Aramaic, the language of Jesus, is still spoken by Christians and some Muslims, has become a one-word argument against Western support for the rebels at the worst possible time for Mr. Obama and the opponents of Mr. Assad. So, above-the-fold story in the front page of the electronic version of the New York Times right now, the headline, Assault on Christian Town in Syria Adds to Fears Over Rebels. So, you know, the situation continues to get more complex. Anyhow, I've been promising you for a couple of days the story, the true history of the Libertarian Party. And I want to share this with you. I think it's interesting that the New York Times and other publications are talking about populism. And they talk about Rand Paul, and they talk about these libertarians and Ron Paul. And they know such thing. Populism is of, by, and for the people, right? It's a politician who's speaking about the folks. Back in 1950, there were hearings in the U.S. Congress, literally in the year 1950, that exposed both Milton Friedman and this organization called FEE, F-E-E, the Foundation for Economic Education, which is the founding organization, the very first libertarian think tank. Milton Friedman was a business lobby shill. He worked for whoever would pay him the most money. And the committee was called the Buchanan Committee because it was put together by the pro-labor Democrat from Pennsylvania, Frank Buchanan. And what they found was that back in 1946, the real estate lobby had a problem. And that was something called rent controls. They did not like rent control. So they found this lobbying outfit, the Foundation for Economic Education, which was a big business PR project. I'm getting a lot of this, by the way, and occasionally words or phrases from Mark Ames in his piece published most recently on Alternet about the history of the Libertarian Party. The Foundation for Economic Education was put together by GM, Chrysler, Ford, U.S. Steel, National Steel, Republic Steel, the Gulf Oil, Standard Oil, Sun Oil, DuPont, Monsanto, Con Ed, B.F. Goodrich, Eli Lilly, Merrill Lynch, General Electric, and other Fortune 500 companies. They put together the Foundation for Economic Education. the first libertarian think tank, and they invented the word libertarianism. Invented this in 1946, right after the war was over. The Foundation for Economic Education, it was headed up by a fellow by the name of Leonard Reed, who was an executive with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and a fellow by the name of Donaldson Brown, who was a director of the National Association of Manufacturers, a lobby group, and a board member on both DuPont and General Motors. Now, consider this. Also on the board of directors of FEE at that time was Robert Welch, who, if you're not of a certain age, you may not recognize that name. I do. He's the guy who founded the John Birch Society. And J. Reuben Clark, who was to quote Mark Ames, a frothing racist and anti-Semite, and the most powerful figure in the Mormon Church at the time. They named a law school at BYU after him. And the president of United Fruit. You remember United Fruit? This is the organization that Cesar Chavez back in the 60s was striking against, trying to create the American Farm Workers Union. United Fruit, the president of United Fruit, or Herb Cornell. And as Mark Ames writes, the purpose of the FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, and libertarianism, this new theology that they invented out of whole cloth in 1946, the purpose was to supplement big business lobbying with a pseudo-intellectual, pseudo-economic rationale to back up their policy and legislative attacks on labor and government regulations. So what this congressional committee discovered when they investigated FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, and they investigated the libertarian movement, it had not yet formed a political party. What they found was Milton Friedman was a paid shill working for them, and that they had just taken on this big contract for the National Association of Realtors. Herbert Nelson, by the way, was the chief lobbyist and executive vice president of the National Association of Real Estate Boards. He wrote, and I quote, and by the way, you will hear libertarians say this proudly, quote, "I do not believe in democracy. I think it stinks. I don't think anyone except direct taxpayers should be allowed to vote. I don't believe women should be allowed to vote at all. Ever since they started, our public affairs have been a worse mess than ever, ever since women started voting." Now, you may remember this is a sentiment that was fairly closely shared recently by a billionaire who was on Ron Paul's campaign in 2012. So the libertarians haven't changed much over the years. They've always just been basically a front for big business.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As John Kenneth Galbraith said, the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. Okay, so now you understand, what's going on in the Middle East. You understand the history of the Libertarian Party that has started out as a front for big business, and still is to a large extent. And I keep referring to Archduke Ferdinand, and people keep calling and saying, "What's the timeline of World War I?" Let me just quickly share it with you, and then I'll pick up your calls here. This is going to take a minute or two, though. Keep in mind, throughout much of this, we had as President Woodrow Wilson, and he was desperately trying to get the United States into World War I, and the American people were desperately opposed to it. And I learned about this back in the 1970s when I studied advertising and public relations, and I actually used to teach advertising and public relations for the American Marketing Center. First, I had to learn it. And what I learned was that Woodrow Wilson hired Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, who was an American, to invent public relations. Bernays literally, and this is something Glenn Beck loves to go off on, Bernays literally invented public relations for the purpose of selling Americans on World War I. Okay. So through much of this, Bernays and Woodrow Wilson are trying to crank up American public opinion, and you'll see how long it took. So here, the backstory behind World War I was two crises. They were called the Bosnian crisis and the Moroccan crisis. The Bosnian crisis happened when Austria and Hungary were basically one country. It was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or sometimes referred to as Austria-Hungary. And they took over Bosnia, which had been a Turkish province, and this happened in 1909. And then the Moroccan crisis happened 2 years later in 1911, and this was one that, see, that one had PO'd Serbia. This one PO'd Germany. They were very upset in 1911 when the French seized Morocco. Okay, so you got that. That's the backstory. So that's the tension between these countries. And the way it ended up playing out, ultimately, is that on one side you had the Allies, and on the other side you had the Central Powers. It's very different from World War II. So the Central Powers were basically Germany, Austria-Hungary, Turkey, and Bulgaria. These four countries were like the bad guys, which is why Germany had to pay all those war reparations with the Treaty of Versailles, okay? Because they were seen as like the ringleaders. The good guys, the Allies, in World War I were, in no particular order, Russia, France, the British Empire, Italy, the United States, Japan, Romania, Serbia, Belgium, Greece, Portugal, and Montenegro. So here's the timeline. 28th of June, 1914, Archduke Ferdinand is visiting Sarajevo, which at that time was the Austrian-Hungarian province of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And he was assassinated by a guy by the name of Gavrilo Princip, who worked for or with or was a member of the Black Hand Group, which was a terrorist organization, arguably a Serbian nationalist organization. They wanted independence from the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Okay, that was July 28th, 1914. 3 days later, excuse me, that was 28th of June 1914. 1 month later, July 28th, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, and that was the official beginning of the war. Okay. But it was just a little thing. It was Austria-Hungary versus Serbia. 3 days later, Russia announced that they were mobilizing their army and called on the French to mobilize. And then so this is like July 31st. The next day, August 1st, 1914, Germany declared war on Russia. And this is why Germany is blamed for so much of this, because they just, you know, hey, let's declare war on Russia. 2 days after that, August 3rd, Germany declares war on France and invaded Belgium. The British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, on August 3rd of 1914, then sent a telegram, an ultimatum, to Germany saying, get the hell out of Belgium. You must withdraw. That was August 3rd. Germany said, no, we're not going to withdraw. The next day, August 4th, Britain declared war on Germany. 2 days later, August 6th, 1914, Austria-Hungary declares war on Russia, joining Germany, right, which had done so a week earlier. A week later, August 13th, 1914, Japan declares war on Germany. Now, how Japan got in the middle of this thing, I have no idea. But other than that, these guys, they all had treaties with each other, and they were all invoking them. By November, a couple months later, Russia, November 2nd, 1914, Russia declared war on Turkey. November 5th, 3 days later, France and Britain declared war on Turkey. Now Turkey's in this thing. Then a whole bunch of fighting happened for the next 6 months. And on May 7th, 1915, a German ship, the Lusitania, was sunk by a German U-boat, which I'm not sure it's German, but Lusitania would imply that. Anyhow, there were a lot of Americans aboard. And that May 7th, 1915, sinking of the Lusitania was the main thing that Bernays and Woodrow Wilson seized on to get Americans upset about World War I, to say, we've got a dog in this fight. I shouldn't even use that phrase. Somebody emailed me the other day saying you're advocating violence of animals. We've got some skin in the game, whatever. 2 weeks later, Italy declares war on Germany. We still have not joined the war. This is 1915, okay, in May 1915. I say May? Yeah, May 7th and May 12th. Okay, fighting goes on for 6 months. October 14th, 1915, Bulgaria declares war on Serbia. The next day, October 15th, 1915, the UK declares war on Bulgaria. The next day, October 16th, France declares war on Bulgaria. Everybody's invoking their treaties. A whole bunch of fighting goes on through the rest of 1915 into 1916 and throughout most of 1916, and still we're outside the war. November 28th, 1916, the first German air raids over London. December 31st, Rasputin was murdered. Now, Rasputin was kind of the power behind the throne. That's a whole another long story in Russia, but this then sparked, arguably, 3 months later, March 15, 1917, the Russian Revolution. So Russia's now completely flipped in the game. And so 1 month later, about 3 weeks later, April 6, 1917, the USA said, okay, enough, and we got into it. We officially declared war on Germany. April 6, 1917. And that helped turn the tide of war, and over the next 2 years, that war was fought heavily. And finally, the Hindenburg Line collapsed in the largely toward the end of October of 1918. And on November 9th, Kaiser Wilhelm II abdicated. The Kaiser, the King of Germany, stepped down on November 9th, 1918, which was officially, for all practical purposes, the end of the war. 3 days later, on November 11th, at 11 a.m., the armistice was signed in France. And that's why it was actually at 11:11 a.m. on November 11th, on 11:11. And for a lot of people, for a lot of years, particularly those who have ancestors, my grandfather fought in World War One, who have ancestors who remember World War One and so have living memory of it, even though I wasn't alive when World War One happened. My grandfather told me stories. And that date of November 11 at 11:11 a.m. has kind of a mystical significance. That was the peace treaty that was supposed to end all wars, the end of all war. And that's in part why Louise and I chose to get married on November 11th at 11:11 a.m. in Detroit in, as I recall, 1972. I think that was the year. Maybe it was 71, whatever. It was back then. Long time ago, 42 or 3 years ago. Yeah, Shane and Jim are both laughing hard now. Husband makes mistake husband should never make. Whack, whack. There goes the phone. Okay, so anyhow, that's World War One. That's the history of World War One. And Mickey wants to get in on this. Hey, Mickey in Chicago, thanks for listening to WCPT. You had some thoughts on the U.S. getting into World War One.
Hi, yeah. No, that was a pretty thorough analysis. I mean, I'm not an expert, but my understanding was that there was an actual a telegram that was the flashpoint of the USA getting involved. That it was sort of jumped on when someone in Germany actually sent a telegram to Mexico asking Mexico if the USA did get involved in the war, would Mexico be willing to attack the United States? And Mexico didn't really seem keen on that idea, but
I'd be willing to bet that Edward Bernays invented that.
It's been disputed whether or not that was true, but
yeah,
whether the telegram happened.
Yeah.
But that was the PR point that got people behind.
It would have Wilson used.
War,
okay.
There was a lot of isolationism prior to that.
Oh, and massively. The Americans, we were sitting here going, hey, no thanks. I mean, keep in mind, in 1916, when we entered the war, there were still a lot of people alive who survived the Civil War. Right, there were people who were children when the Civil War happened, and they were like, I don't want another war, thank you very much. And they had grandparents who had survived the War of 1812. So it's like, you know, yeah, excellent. Mickey, thanks for sharing that bit of trivia. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, where we're learning all about the Libertarian Party, World War One, Archduke Ferdinand, the Black Hand in Sarajevo, and the future of Syria.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Not necessarily in that order. And I you know, Rand Paul, he's anti-war. Why? I'll speculate on that after. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Deacon in Boulder Creek, California. You know about the telegram that was used to get us into World War One. Tell us about it.
It's called the XYZ Affair.
No, the XYZ Affair was during the John Adams presidency.
Okay, the Zimmerman telegram.
I'm sorry?
The Zimmerman telegram. It was a telegram that one of the Kaiser's officials sent to the president of Mexico, that offered to give him the southern United States if Mexico would invade the United States and create a second front. That's what got the United States into the war.
Okay.
But Woodrow Wilson didn't just use public relations to get the United States into the war. He also created this incredible spy network that put people in prison for criticizing the war effort, including a United States congressman.
You're right.
And that's why Glenn Beck hates Woodrow Wilson, and that's why I hate Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, that's why I'm not too happy with him either. That was the Alien Sedition Act of 1919? No, it must have been
1916.
Yeah. And so Woodrow Wilson brought us the Alien and Sedition Act, did you say the XYZ Affair?
Yes.
I know about the XYZ Affair that happened during the John Adams administration. I can recite case and verse of all the details on that one, but this was referred to as the XYZ Affair also?
If my memory serves me, what happened was the British intelligence translated, decoded the telegram,
right,
and then they turned around and gave it to the United States, but they didn't want to up the fact that they had the encryption, so they allowed the United States to claim that they decoded the telegram, and Woodrow Wilson used that as an excuse to go into the First World War.
And where did the XYZ come from?
You're going to have to get that from somebody else.
Okay.
But I just don't remember.
That's just, funny alphabet letters to indicate that we decoded it or something. That's interesting. Deacon, I got to do a little more digging on this. Maybe David has an idea. Deacon, thank you for the call. Maybe David has an idea in Chicago. Listening to WCPT, you studied World War One and World War Two at the university.
Yes. First of all, the Zimmerman telegram, that was a book written by Barbara Tuchman, a foremost historian. So if you want to read up on that.
Okay.
But there's interesting parallels between today's Middle East strife and what happened in World War One. In World War One, you had all these different royal houses related to each other, fighting each other, and as a result, all these royal houses were deposed except for the UK. In Middle East, you had the Hashemite clan divided up between Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iraq. All were deposed except Saudi Arabia today.
Mm-hmm.
You have the ethnic...
Well, Syria he was deposed by the Assad family in 71.
Yes, in Iraq it was the late 50s.
Right, right, okay.
So in other words, so you have the royal houses set up by the UK and Middle East.
Right.
So you have that parallel. You have the parallel of all these ethnic fault lines that Niall Ferguson and Timothy Snyder referred to that led to all this strife. And you had ethnic minorities trying to run countries. Hitler was an Austrian. The Bolsheviks were largely Jews and Georgians. Okay, you have the same thing in Syria and in these other countries where you have the minority Sunnis in Iraq that were under Saddam Hussein who were trying to manage the majority Shias.
Right.
So you have those ethnic fault lines. But going back to the U.S. getting into World War One, remember, it was loans that were made by U.S. banks, by J.P. Morgan, that they did not want to lose if the UK and France lost the war, and that was the main reason to get the U.S. into World War One.
Oh, wow. So we loaned them money to fight the war, our banks did, and our banksters were afraid that if they lost the war, the loans would never be repaid.
Yes,
and
that was
so
the main impetus to get the U.S. into the war, and what today we have...
Now, is that a documented piece of history, or is that a conspiracy theory associated generally with history?
No, in fact, I thought I had heard you refer to that at one time, but if you do your research, this is common knowledge about one of the main reasons to get the U.S. into the war because of all the financing going on, that J.P. Morgan and the banksters of Wall Street, they would not get that money back. It was over $1 billion, which is a lot of money back then.
Right.
And now today we have the same thing.
Which would be $1 trillion today, probably.
Yes. I mean, so you have the royal house parallel. You have the ethnic fault lines. And remember, Balkanization. I mean, we use that term today to refer to all these ethnic fault lines that are occurring in this country and in Europe. I mean, it took up to World War II to finally settle borders that had been broken open as a result of because of World War I and after World War I, while these individual nation states grew up. And both the Bolsheviks and the Nazis, they couldn't stand an independent Poland.
Right, right. And would it be safe to say that after World War I, what the Allied powers did was they just basically recreated the pre-World War I kind of kingdom system out of the former Ottoman Empire, down the what we call the Middle Eastern countries now?
Well, I mean, the UK took over some of those areas. I don't know that...
You're talking about the Hashemite Kingdom and all these...
Well, remember, they had Transjordan, you had Mesopotamia, you had Palestine.
Right.
And, of course, they discovered oil in Saudi Arabia. And so they took this clan that it was descendant from Muhammad, like the great-grandson or whatever, and they said, okay, someone's going to take Syria, another cousin or whatever is going to take Iraq, and so on. And so... You essentially have a parallel to the royal houses,
right?
And remember, the royal houses go back. I mean, remember, the Romanovs were 300 years old.
Sure,
we're talking about Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And remember, German was spoken from the French border all the way to the Volga River and to the Black Sea. So it was pan-German lingua franca. So that's why Germany felt that they had a sense of destiny and of responsibility for Europe. Because of all the far-flung German-speaking colonies throughout, from France, from the French border, all the way to almost Asia.
Right, and then 30 years later, this is, or even less than that, I guess, this is why Hitler said, we got to take the Sudetenland, it's part of the fatherland, etc.
And Tom, remember this, between the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in the spring of 1918 and the armistice in the fall of 1918, Germany occupied the Ukraine. And because Lenin wanted to get settled peace with Germany so they could take over remaining Russia.
Wow. David, Shano has said that you're the guy who's going to get the book today. You've been sharing World War I, World War II history with us. Thank you so much. I'll share with you the history of corporate personhood in the United States from 1815 to today in my book, Unequal Protection, if you would like. And if so, I'm going to put you on hold, and Danielle will pick up your address. Hang on.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we have been talking at some length about the detailed history and timeline of World War I, the parallels between that and what we're seeing in the Middle East right now, the possible parallels, and perils as well, and the history of the Libertarian Party back to its origin in 1946 as a corporate PR marketing group for some of the largest corporations in America, inventing the word libertarian as a philosophy and ultimately a political party purely for the purposes of advancing the interests of these very large corporations, which is just an absolutely fascinating history. And, of course, we've been getting into at some length what's going on with Syria, what's going on with Russia, what's going on with the United States. We'll return to all of those topics in just a moment. But the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research has recently introduced a Civic Report, number 79, September 2013, titled Better Pay, Fairer Pensions, Reforming Teacher Compensation, written by Josh McGee and Marcus Winters. And Marcus Winters of the Manhattan Institute, manhattan-institute.org is the website, is on the line with us. Marcus, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. It looks to me, first of all, there are two kinds of retirement plans that people typically have had. Historically, largely up until the last 30 years, in large part because of changes in the tax code made during the Reagan administration, most people had what were called defined benefit plans, also known as pensions, where you pay a small part of your income into it throughout your working life, And but you know, every year, you know, okay, if I finish this year of employment, when I retire at 65 or whatever the age is, when I retire, I will have $312 a month, or I will have, you know, $1,600 a month. I know that because the benefit is known. It's defined. And every additional year that you work, that benefit goes up. But you know what that benefit's going to be. That's how pensions work. And then there's something called the defined contribution plan, also known as the wealth. You talk about this as the cash balance, smooth accrual plan, which is where I put money into this thing every month, and I can open my checking account or my Merrill Lynch brokerage account and see that in there I have $116,012.16. And I hope that that's going to be enough for when I retire. And if I'm 30 years old, if I invest that wisely and the stock market doesn't crash, that will become millions of dollars and I'll be able to retire a rich guy. Are we on the same page so far?
I think, yes, there are those two different types of plans.
Okay.
Yep.
So my read of your Better Pay, Fairer Pensions study is basically, let's give teachers, let's move them out of pension plans and into 401ks so that I didn't see the so that in there, frankly. But by doing so, because pensions are a little more expensive because you know what you're going to get. So there's a little more risk on the part of the pension company. You can take that leftover money and give the teachers a pay raise. And presumably they can take some of that money and put it into their 401ks. Do I have that right?
No, actually, that's not okay. What we're saying in this paper. So our paper, we do talk a little bit about, you know, the current systems of defined benefits. And one way you could change it is into a defined contribution or into a cash balance plan, which is really a defined benefit plan, except that it has more kind of direct accounts. And actually, in our paper,
plan a defined benefit plan?
I'm sorry?
Your paper, and I'm quoting from your well-designed defined contribution DC systems, which are common in higher education and the private sector, provide smooth wealth accrual. These are like 401ks. So do, quote, cash balance, smooth accrual plans, which provide additional investment protection and require less employee decision-making than a DC. What is a smooth accrual plan? If I wanted to sign up for one, how do I do that? How does it work?
Well, you need your employer to have it in the first place. So what we're doing is...
What's the tax code phrase for that? How do you...
We can stay completely within the defined benefit structure. What we're really talking about is the fact that teacher pensions right now, I think there are problems with DBs in, along with this, but the problem with them right now is that they're very heavily backloading wealth late into a teacher's career. So the problem, and what we've decided...
Right, you get to have a good retirement.
I'm sorry?
You get to have a good retirement. You know that you're going to, you know, hey, I'm putting up with these crazy kids all day, every day, and I'm not paid the best in the world, but at least I know when I retire I'm going to have a nice life, I can travel the world.
That's our problem here is you get to have a good retirement if you stay within the system until age of 63. So again, we can have a guaranteed payout. You can have a DB that works exactly how you described. You're going to leave the system, and after that, you will know exactly how much you're going to get.
Right. Well, even if you retire at 40 or 50,
is that it's so heavily backloaded. So if you are a teacher who's in New York City, for instance, who stays in the school system for 20 years, that's a very long time to be there, and you leave, perhaps maybe your spouse took a job in the Midwest. Under the current system, you know that you're going to get a certain amount at the time that you retire at about the age of 63, but you've only actually gained about $50,000 in employer-sponsored retirement wealth at that time. And there's nothing inherent in defined benefit that makes us do that. There's nothing inherent that says we have to put all of the wealth later into life. And what the current plans are really doing is they're taking money away from teachers who leave the school systems before 35 years or so and giving that money to the teachers who actually stay that long. So, and I think you might have an argument that maybe that's okay to do with teachers who are only there for, say, 5 years. But the current system is doing that with teachers who have been there for 20 years or so. And what we're asking for...
How so? I thought if you had a pension... You wouldn't get as much if you left after a few years of contributing to the pension, but you still had a pension.
Yes, but what we're showing
I have a brother-in-law who's in
this
situation.
The pension that you get is very, very, very small. So in those first two decades of service, so to put it in this way, and we kind of model this in present values, but again, staying completely within the defined benefit system,
if you, under the current system, a teacher in New York City, for instance, earns about $3,000, the equivalent of about $3,000 of employer-sponsored retirement wealth during their first 20 years. But then if you stay in the system after that for another 15 to 20 years, you'll earn about another $30,000 per year that you're in the system in what you would expect in retirement wealth. So again, what we're talking about has nothing to do with investment risk of 401ks. You can stay completely within defined benefit system.
So a smooth accrual or a cash balance plan. Give me an example of one of these.
So some states, so Florida, for instance, has adopted something, sort of along these lines. So they have some options that are more 401k style as well. The cash balance plans were a little more popular for large companies as they were moving from traditional DBs into something like a cash balance. And there the idea was that a cash balance is going to, because it's an account that you hold, right, that would be the one thing that has similar to a 401k. So instead of your employer holding it, it's an account that follows you no matter where you go.
Okay, so I hold that account. How is that money invested? Is that my decision or is that somebody else's decision?
It's someone else's decision, and it doesn't.
Okay. How is that money paid back out to me? If I have $100,000 in that account at the time that I retire, do I only get $100,000, or if I live until I'm 90, do I get back $300,000?
If you live until you're 90, you get the payment of X dollars a month, the same way as any defined benefit. So we're not moving anywhere. So there's nothing inherent in what we're talking about. And I think there are reasons to talk about moving to a DC. But that's not the focus of our paper. Our paper is entirely about at what point in your career does the school system give you retirement wealth. And right now, they give you almost nothing in those first 20 years. So if you're a teacher who leaves within the first 20 years, you're leaving with very, very little.
Are these administered by banks?
Is it sponsored by banks?
Are these administered by banks?
This would be run from the same people. It would run the same way as far as a guaranteed amount.
I'm trying to figure out what the angle is here. I guess I've been unable to do so.
The angle is to help teachers who are leaving with very little retirement wealth. That's what we're asking
okay.
for.
Marcus Winters, Manhattan-Institute.org. You can read all about it. Thank you, Marcus.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with more about... I just learned something about the Lusitania. I've got to share with you. Stick around. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. When I was reading you that timeline of World War I history, which, by the way, came from a timeline of World War I and the... The URL did not print on the page, so I can't give it to you. My apologies, but if you DuckDuckGo timeline of World War I, it'll pop right up. There's a bunch of them out there, but this was a particularly good one. They just mentioned the Lusitania. During the break, Danielle had tracked down one of these, three world wars overview of the true causes of World War I from threeworldwars.com, and they talked about how the it is argued that the Lusitania, which was, I said I thought maybe it was a German cruise ship. No, it was owned by Cunard Line, and it was turned over to the British Admiralty after they joined World War I. And the Lusitania came to the United States, and quoting from this page, the ship was sent to New York City where it was loaded with 6 million rounds of ammunition owned by J.P. Morgan and Company to be sold to England and France to aid in their war against Germany. And then they go through this whole thing about who was loaning money to whom and how, and the ocean liner was set to sail to England, and Secretary Bryan promised that he would endeavor to persuade President Woodrow Wilson to warn Americans not to travel aboard the Lusitania. No such warning was issued by the president, though. He did nothing. The Lusitania basically was sunk off the coast of Ireland. About 1,204 people died. And there are suggestions, 1,201 people died, suggestions, a book by Colin Simpson in the book The Lusitania, that Churchill basically positioned the boat where he knew there were U-boats and made it sit in the water for a while the smaller boat was supposed to go out and meet it. off the coast of Ireland, knowing that the Germans would sink it, which they did, which then that became one of the rallying cries. I also have the Zimmermann telegram. Zimmermann with two N's on the end, the German spelling of the name, as received by the German ambassador to Mexico. It says, this is the decoded version. We have the, both the coded version, which is 130-13042, 13401, 8501. You don't want to hear that one. And here's the decoded version sent from London. We intend to begin on the 1st of February unrestricted submarine warfare. We shall endeavor. Now, this is Germany to Mexico. We shall endeavor, in spite of this, to keep the United States of America neutral. In the event of this not succeeding, we make Mexico a proposal of alliance on the following basis. Make war together, make peace together, generous financial support, and an understanding on our part that Mexico is to reconquer the lost territories in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The settlement in detail is left to you. You will inform the president of the above, president of Mexico, of the above most secretly as soon as the outbreak of war with the United States is certain, and add the suggestion that he should, on his own initiative, invite Japan to immediate adherence and at the same time mediate between Japan and ourselves. That would be Germany. Please call the president's attention to the fact that the ruthless employment of our submarines now offers the prospect of compelling England in a few months to make peace. Signed, Zimmermann. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. Charles in Montgomery, Illinois. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Yes. At the G20 summit, I wonder if Obama gave a backhanded apology to Putin, saying, well, you know what's going on in Syria. I wonder if, I'm not certain, but, you know, when we do take military action, some of your interests may get destroyed. I apologize in advance, and I don't want this to sour our relations.
I kind of doubt that the president would say that. I could, however, imagine President Putin saying, and this is not, you know, any, I have no inside knowledge of this, and I don't know either of these men, but from what I know of the public record, you could imagine President Putin saying to President Obama, as frankly President Obama would probably say to President Putin if President Putin was thinking about attacking Cuba, where we have a military base, Guantanamo Bay, if you attack Syria and it messes with our military base, you are going to be in deep doo-doo, sir. You think?
Yes. And
then Obama might say, well, how do we work this out? Or, hey, I have an idea.
I think it's possibly because there are pipelines that are strategic to Russia in Syria.
Yes.
And that might be what they were.
Oh,
well, there's some things. They're near pipelines. It might happen. We're going to try to avoid it, but, you know, things happen.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Charles, excellent point. Thanks for the call. James in Lafayette, Indiana. Hey, James, treaties in the Middle East?
Yes, Tom. I enjoy your program very much.
Thank you.
The comment I would make is we need to abrogate the treaties of Lausanne and Cairns from 1920 and 1924, decide that the 90-year experiment did not work.
Wait a second. Who are these treaties with? I'm unfamiliar with these two treaties you just named.
This is how Turkey was split up after the First World War.
Okay.
The British and the French basically did it. The Americans were not there. The Russians were not there. So what I'm suggesting to move forward now that we have the big powers talking and agreeing, let's have the Security Council, Turkey and Iraq, and the people that are there, redivide that area so it makes sense from an ethnic standpoint, from a religious standpoint.
To give the Kurds their autonomy, to give the Sunnis and the Shia their autonomy. Is that what you're talking about?
That is correct.
This is what Joe Biden, you'll recall, was suggesting when he was running for president in 2000, or in 2000, right, 2008, excuse me.
Yeah, so anyway, that, I think this, a world conference with the right people, we could get the whole Middle East thing settled down and move on to more important things.
Yeah, let's just develop some small countries. We won't need dictators. Give people their autonomy. This is what I was talking about yesterday that Thomas Friedman was pointing out, that, you know, it's all the same war. It's, you get rid of the dictator and all the people who used to fight with each other, and the dictator was keeping them from fighting with each other, go back to fighting with each other. And it's not a good thing. James, excellent point. Thank you very much. And, thanks for watching the program on Free Speech TV. Thanks for the call. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Right after the break, an update on what's happening right now with regard to this Russian-U.S.-Syrian proposal. The good, the bad, and the very, very nasicornously ugly. The good! Moo Cluck Moo! The Michigan-based burger chain is already one of the most generous employers in the country, paying its entry-level, yes, entry-level workers a salary of $12 an hour. But come October, it will start paying those entry-level workers even better. On October 1st, all Moo Cluck Moo employees will start earning a base wage of $15 an hour, matching the demands of the fast food workers who took to the streets this summer to demand a living wage. Moo Cluck Moo's CEO, Brian Parker, told the Daily Beast that we always wanted our wages to be at $15 an hour. It just feels human to do it. Parker's right. $15 an hour is more human. It's time for a national living wage. Good on Moo Cluck Moo for leading the way. The bad. SeaWorld. Unfortunately, not every employer can be like Moo Cluck Moo, and SeaWorld, the Orlando, Florida theme park, made famous by Shamu the killer whale, has announced that it is cutting hours for part-time employees so it won't have to provide them with health insurance plans as mandated by Obamacare. Although SeaWorld's profits have taken a hit over the past year, it's still a multi-million dollar business that has more than enough money to pay for employee health plans. The plan to cut workers' hours is just cheap political grandstanding at its worst. Don't go to SeaWorld. And the very, very ugly George Zimmerman. A few months ago, the NRA's prodigal son barely escaped prison time for killing Trayvon Martin. That hasn't stopped him from getting into trouble since then, however. On Monday, Zimmerman allegedly threatened his estranged wife and his father-in-law with a gun. Prosecutors have declined to charge Zimmerman, but I think it's safe to say that if he's up to this sort of stuff, even after his brush with justice earlier this summer, he hasn't learned his lesson at all. And that is just very, very ugly. Incredibly ugly. Okay, at 9 o'clock tonight, the president is going to give his speech. And we're all going to find out, you know, what he has to say. Meanwhile, the New York Times just did a public opinion poll. And they asked the question, do you think the U.S. should or should not take the leading role among all other countries in the world in trying to solve international conflicts? 62% of Americans said no, we should not. Then they said, should the U.S. try to change a dictatorship to a democracy where it can, or should the U.S. stay out of other countries' affairs? 72% of Americans said we should stay out of other people's affairs. And then they said, do you think the Obama administration has clearly explained what the U.S.'s goals are in Syria, or have they not done that yet? 79% of Americans said they have not yet done that, explained their goals in Syria. So President Obama has a heavy lift tonight, unless the essence of his speech is going to be, me and Vlad have got this thing worked out. We got this under control. Don't worry, guys. It's in the bag. We'll see. It's going to be very interesting. I'm very much looking forward to it. Ray in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Ray, thanks for listening to WCPT and for calling in. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I was listening to that guy talking about those new ideas for replacing pension plans, and I completely agree with you. There's got to be a scam there somewhere. In my opinion, 401ks are one of the biggest redistributions of wealth scams ever pulled on workers.
Oh, yeah.
The first clue is that you go from a defined benefit to a defined contribution. In other words, instead of someone guaranteeing you something, you have to guarantee to give them a certain amount of your money with no real guarantee you'll get what you're promising in. You could end up with nothing.
Right. If you invest it in the stock market and it crashes.
Yeah.
The 401ks require everybody in America to become investment experts. And there's a whole industry now as a result of this of people basically selling investment advice. And you pay three different investment advisors, you'll get three different suggestions, and they all conflict with each other, and it's crazy.
Yeah,
making a lot of money for banksters, though.
Yeah, they don't create these plans for the benefit of beneficiaries.
You know,
they're in the business of gaining asset access to and direct control over tens and hundreds of billions of dollars that otherwise would be under the control of pension funds and those who manage them.
Yep.
They come up with these clever ways to frame it, like, you know, well, it's your money and all that. Well, in the end, you're at their mercy. And the only thing that's happened in the private sector, when you think back, is it just made companies more profitable when they went to 401ks because they reduced their legacy costs, which meant more money for CEOs and the people who own and run them and rich investors, all while middle-class workers end up with much less in the long run.
Yep.
So
I agree.
Yeah, it's a scam.
I agree. I haven't been able to figure out what it was, but I never got a straight answer to give me an example of one of these. If he had said, you know, it's Smith Works Iron Works in McHenry, Illinois, you can see where, you know, there's 34 workers there and they all voted to do this. Or if he could name one union that had voted to do it, because I'd like to see a democratic institution, you know, where the workers actually have a say in it that has decided to go along with this. He was unable to name one. And that's a huge red flag for me that there's something going on here that is not going to work out so well for workers. But I honestly don't know what it is. So I'm just color me skeptical. Ray, thanks for the call. I agree with you. Mike, speaking of McHenry, Illinois, Mike in McHenry, Illinois, what's up?
Tom, do you know how rare it is for two people from McHenry, Illinois to not be Republicans?
No.
Extremely.
Really? Okay.
Listen.
See, you and Ray are the you win the back-to-back prize today.
Two in a row, man. Hey, listen, I'm also a university, college history guy. And you're right. The XYZ affair started under the Washington administration, and it leaked into the Adams administration. And it involved the First French Republic, and it involved Britain stealing ships from the French and the British, and it involved, you know, the beginning of the Napoleonic Wars and sort of the trade issues with...
And it involved George Marshall.
Exactly.
George Marshall was one of the three guys who went over there. You know, he's the guy who became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1800, who in 1803 in Marbury versus Madison directed the ruling, along with Samuel Chase, one of his buddies who was almost impeached, was almost convicted. And by the way, I should correct myself. Yesterday I said Bill Clinton was within a vote of being convicted. He wasn't. It was Andrew Johnson who was. But in any case, George Marshall was the guy who brought us the idea that the Supreme Court can strike down laws and create policies, which has brought us
judicial review in the court, which we
judicial review
constitution that
right our constitutional monarchy.
World War One. And your last academic caller, until 1915, there was a ban on loaning money, private bank loans to the Allies. And in 1915, Wilson lifted that loan because J.P. Morgan. Your last caller had it, but a little reversed. J.P. Morgan did indeed finance what was known as the Triple Entente in World War One, which was the union between England, France, and Russia until Russia came out of the war and went along their revolution themselves, which will bring me to another point in a second. But the cracks were falling apart in the Habsburg Empire very badly, and Serbia and the Baltic states were pushing very, very hard for a greater pan-Serbia. And the caller was correct in the sense that dating back, I mean, you can go back to the 13th or 14th century, and it was very common for these families to intermarry throughout these kingdoms.
Oh, sure.
Throughout Europe, and this was starting to crack and fall apart. One thing that was very disturbing to me, especially coming from an academic, is the claim that the Bolsheviks were Jews. It's not true.
Mm.
Because of diaspora, which is the Hebrew term, the displacement of the Jewish people dating back to the Old Testament, it's very, very difficult to link the actual culture of Judaism to the Bolsheviks. Were some of them culturally Jews? Yes, but that ideology is the same type of ideology that has blamed the Jews for the bubonic plague,
for everything else, yeah,
Christ,
yeah,
so on and so forth. Yeah. Now, if you look at,
thank you for putting that on the record, Mark.
The Espionage Act was used, as we know, it put Eugene Debs in prison.
Mm-hmm.
What is very striking about this time and what is really kind of taken out of the American narrative history is that when World War I was breaking out, the socialist movement in America, the Wobblies, IWW, these people were making enormous gains, enormous. The local mayoral candidates in New York and Chicago were going from like
2% of the vote to 35-37% of the vote.
Wow. So, and this was all the result of basically 20 years of intense progressive activity coming out of the crash of 1898. Well, and the progressive movement before that, too, but, you know, that we saw with the Roosevelt.
The last time you and I spoke, we spoke about the Ludlow Massacre.
Right.
If you look at and you read Howard Zinn, you will see Howard Zinn lineate the Ludlow Massacre right into World War One. And J.P. Morgan was very, very eager to open up these markets, and he was horrified at the idea that Europe was going to be taken over by the Austrians. Because remember, Germany really kind of got sucked into World War One, and had Napoleon and the Franco-Prussian War not happened and France storming their way across the continent of Europe, it's very likely that Germany would not have been so aggressive. I don't want to make excuses for Hitler. I never can. He was a madman and a demon. But these German sort of rhetoric, keep in mind, France was occupying the Rhine.
Right.
Germany was outrageously humiliated.
Oh, they were humiliated in World War One, and the Treaty of Versailles was, you know, so punitive that John Kenneth Galbraith said, if you sign this Treaty of Versailles, you are consigning the next generation to a war.
Indeed, indeed. And the reparations simply could not be paid by Germany. No matter how much they ran their industrial machines, it simply could not happen. So it's very didactic, but,
it's fascinating stuff. Mike, I'm sorry we're out of time. I could have taken a few more minutes on this, but the clock here is an absolutely rigid clock, so... thanks for listening. We will talk again. Appreciate the call. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Herbert Nelson, 1946, chief lobbyist of the National Association of Real Estate Boards, helped invent libertarianism. Welcome back, gentlemen. For the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Nick in Seattle listening on KBCS. Hey, Nick.
Hey, Tom. A long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
It was really great when you were on with 1090, and it's still going strong. It's great here on the community radio station.
Thank you.
I wanted to say something just briefly about the pension thing. I'm a retired teacher, too, and my wife is still a teacher. And I agree with everything the fellows and you have said about it, And it's really, and it's worse.
But keep it as a defined benefit program. Keep it as a pension. Don't let it go 401k. Don't let it go private, as it were.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the problem with the private is, as a person says, a defined contribution, not defined.
You know what just hit me? And I'll bet that this is why the Manhattan Institute is promoting this. Maybe I'm wrong. I shouldn't say them. I should just put it out. He was saying basically it's the same thing as a pension. It's just that you have the control of the account. If you have the control of the account, the union doesn't anymore.
Right. It's that, and it's also that they're really lying because you don't really have that much control over it. You can maybe change your when you're making contributions, you might be able to make two changes a month.
But this would just be like a way of getting the union out of the way, so you no longer need the union. It's one less thing you need a union for.
And then, of course, people segregated without unions are easy pickings.
Right. Now I get it.
He was really slimy. But at one point, I've just been thinking about it because I've been working, trying to do my own investments for 3 years. And like you say, it's full of wolves and thieves, and it's, you know, people saying that right is left and left is right. But one thing I think I've discovered over 3 years of research and work and trying to, you know, develop my own retirement money, you know, from my investments over the years, and as a teacher, is that the high frequency traders are not necessarily our enemies, because they're the ones that add, they're the ones that make it possible for me to go in and buy shares of Apple or whatever for a reasonable price. That's not, you know, not having, instead of having a dollar wide markets, you have penny wide markets or 10-cent wide markets or something like that, because there's so much activity.
The flip side of that, though, is they're also the ones who crash the market when it crashes.
I'm not sure, because I think, I mean, I don't really want to be a spokesman. I think that more had to do with, you know, certain, I can't really say. Yeah. I don't think they did, and I think that's something that they can be managed much better, because at least it puts the power in people's hands to make.
If 70% of all the trades on the NASDAQ are being, or on the Dow,
right,
are being done, the New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, 70% of all those trades are being done by computers without any human looking over them based on algorithms. And it's hundreds of millions of trades a second, or millions of trades a second. And those computers are programmed to run. If the market starts to plunge, then the more the market plunges, the more they're going to run, and the more it's going to plunge, the more they're going to run. And you've got a, you know, a positive feedback loop. You've got a water going down the drain.
Well, I think it was May 10th. It was May 10th, 2010, and I think that was
The day of the program trading glitch. Is that what you're talking about?
The flash crash, and I think the SEC pointed out it was there was some firm in Nebraska or someplace like that who had dumped a huge number of S&P futures contracts on the market all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would have been hard for humans to pick too. And because those things are, they're huge leverage, right?
Yeah. We need to get futures out of the market unless people are counterparties. I mean, it's just that simple. Nick, I've got a whole bunch of calls I want to get in here, and I've only got 3 minutes left in the show. So we'll continue this conversation.
Hey, keep up the work.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Nick. I appreciate it. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. You're disappointed with conservatives on Syria?
Oh, very pissed off with them. Basically, they've been with this war chant that, you know, Iran is going to build this bomb. And right now, if you think about it, the closer that we would get to Syria, even if we bombed Syria, that would put more pressure. I think it would isolate Iran even more. And the conservatives, after preaching about what Iran might do and how the president is looking weak, he's actually looking very strong to the international community. And the thing about it is, you know, it's just propaganda that's coming from, I would say, Fox News and the conservative party.
Yeah, well, let's...
Where's Paul Ryan at this time? Because I believe it was him and Romney advocating war with Iran. And they're not speaking up right now, which is very confusing to me.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know what they have to say right now, but interesting point. Charles, thank you for the call. Joe in Chico, California. Joe?
Hi. I wanted to point out, in most states, but not all states, teachers do not pay into Social Security.
Right, so their pension is their retirement.
Right, so if you're like I am, I changed careers when I was about 35, and so I do have Social Security, but as a teacher, I'm docked about, I think it's like 40% on my Social Security because of the windfall protection provision in the tax code.
Hmm. Interesting.
So I will not get the full benefit of my Social Security that I earned.
Right.
Because I wanted to do something important.
Because you were a teacher for a while. That's a perverse incentive. That should not be. Joe, thanks for the info on that. I know that that's not just the case with teachers. It's the case with a number of public workers in different places around the country, and it's a loophole in the Social Security Act that probably shouldn't have been put there. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Mike in Lebanon, Missouri. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, Tom, I wonder sort of, I don't know if you know this or not, but Russia and China now have warships parked outside of Syria, and right now 160,000 Russian troops are doing drills that they're going to land on shore. And if there are no boots from the United States...
Yeah, I had not heard that, Mike, and I would be suspicious of the source of it. But, you just shared it with a couple million people. We'll figure out whether it's true or not. Thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, the latest news on Syria, plus a conversation with Congressman Peter DeFazio as the debate on the Hill continues. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does begin with you. You've got to show up, get active, occupy something, go to pdamerica.org or some, you know, your favorite place and just say, yes, I want to participate. Tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.